Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 9th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Ann Peterson. Today's session number is 10 and is titled Conversation, Theological Method for Engaging Difference. Let's listen in.
I'm Ann Peterson, and this session is called Us and Them, Conversation, a Theological Method for Dealing with Difference. I put negotiating. How many of you were new to this session? Okay, a fair number of you. Okay, I'm just going to do, we keep doing sort of a little follow-up, and I'll do that in part as a summary for why I'm doing this last session as well, what's grown out of. I teach at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, for those of you that are new, and not Rock Island, and teach at the other Augie. And I teach religion and philosophy. And this title of this week, Us and Them, grew out of the freshman religion course that a colleague and I taught, a New Testament professor, a first-year course that we all teach in some form called Exploring the Christian Faith. And we decided that much of the way Christianity has known itself has been alongside and over against working out its identity among diverse groups, and that one of the most difficult issues facing first-year through fourth-year college students is how to deal with difference, especially for many of our students. I mentioned to this group that 52% of our students are Lutheran, about 25% Roman Catholic, mostly rural, upper Midwest, Iowa, South Dakota, Minnesota. So for many of them, their idea of difference is living with a new roommate, which can, in and of itself, be a pretty traumatic event. If you haven't had, you've had your own room your whole life, you've had everything going on. And so this course developed in such a way that we tried to look at how Christianity deals with the tension that diversity brings, both in what I call its problematic forms and its promise. How we struggle with the notion of one Lord, one faith, one baptism, the unity of the Christian faith, and yet looking at the multiplicity of all of its dimensions, particularly in denominational form, and even in theological diversity. If we were to take a sort of poll of all the Lutherans in this room, we would come up with many different understandings of even basic Lutheran doctrine. That brings both, I think, excitement and enthusiasm for how we understand the Christian faith. It also brings those difficult questions that we've tried to wrestle with through the week about, well, what is essential to the Christian faith? What things are non-negotiable? How do we talk about what belongs to the tradition and what doesn't? And what do you do when you engage in these differences that we talked about the first day as us and them? Not just differences of one group alongside another group, but often very much one group over against another group. And that's why I'll put in one more plug. The bookstore said they'd order them for you, but I promised not to read that. I'd love to read this last page in this book because it really summarizes the book, but I won't do it. I promise not to do that. Their Father's God by Ole Rolvag, again, the third part of this trilogy, from Giants on the Earth to Peter Victorious. He's a Norwegian immigrant writer. And we used this book, again, the marriage between Susan Doheny, an Irish Catholic girl, to the Norwegian Lutheran man. Young, I mean, we guess somewhere in their late teens, probably late teens, 18 or so when they get married, have to get married. And the ensuing conflicts that occur in their marriage when they have a child and have it baptized, of course, twice, once Lutheran, once Catholic, and the tensions that develop in this marriage. And I wanted to just read, I've been reading a little bit from this book, and I want to read just a couple sentences today. Peter, who's the young man in the book, this is set in Dakota Territory at the turn of the century, and his mother, Barrett Holm, is getting really antsy with him because he hasn't had this child baptized yet. So Barrett says to Peter, "Isn't it time pretty soon that you have the child baptized?" "No big hurry, is there?" Peter laughed. "Such things are not to be put off too long," said Barrett. Peter turned and filled the manger. They were out in the barn. Barrett waited for him to get through. "I hardly even know what to name him yet." Don't you know what to name him?" She came closer, her voice sweet with kindness. "There surely could be no question about that. Your name is Peter, your father's name was Peter, and so was his father's before him. It's a fine name, and it's been used in your family since time out of mind. It should be good enough for your first child, too. Don't forget that the God of our fathers watches over us, she added admonishingly. We'd have to talk to Susie about it first, said Peter, going on with his work. But then Barrett became more serious. That's not the way your father reasoned when he brought you to baptism. He didn't stop to ask me what I wanted. You mustn't put off this any longer. Have you forgotten what the Bible says of parents who neglect their children's baptism? All right, said Peter as he sulkily left the barn. And of course, as we talked about connected with a Bible study, this is really a scene of the competition between that story in 1 Kings that Maury, we went over. And of course, they baptize the baby and the rain comes and relieves the drought-ridden land. But the book escalates in tension between these two characters until finally the conflicts seem irreversible. Again, a reminder that if you've read Henrik Ibsen's A Dollhouse, it will give you a clue about how the book moves. But the tensions between these two become irresolvable for a number of reasons. The marriage is surrounded, and you can see the pressure from Barrett, calling in the tradition that binds his family. You know, if it's, and you can see even the dynamics in the conversation. Why would you consult your wife about this? At the very beginning of the book, there's sort of an attempt to show maybe a different model of marriage than had been previously used in generations, in which Peter and Susie had some free-flowing exchange of ideas between each other. But as the book progresses, the tensions and the family loyalties become more strained, and they become unable to talk with one another. And, of course, it reached sort of a fevered pitch towards the end of the book. And as you think about how we talk theologically, I forgot the main word up here. How is it that we talk about those differences that both divide and unite us? That's an ongoing concern for me. We raised the issue, I guess that was yesterday, and the day before, about worship, both about the section, the body of Christ broken for you, and yesterday about what constitutes contemporary or traditional worship, and brought up these sort of matters about practice of the faith that reveal deep differences between us. There have been differences during the 2 weeks I've been up here at Holden, people who are on different sides of different issues, and I think Holden provides a pretty comfortable place for talking about those, but many times we engage in talking about the faith in matters that have ended up, at least in my mind, as being anything but conversation, but ending up more like trench warfare, in which sides are taken, pot shots are taken, and eventually the sides do damage. Now, I can think of examples on our campus where we have had issues over certain things that had been raised to such a fevered pitch that the kind of damage that's done is almost irreversible. Groups no longer listen. Somehow we lose the ability to listen. And part of it, I think, has to do with this characterization of us versus them and how hard it is to try to cross this boundary of difference. A colleague of mine that teaches in the government department on our campus is kind of known as the conservative department on campus. And I ended up on one of the faculty councils with this man, and my first impression was, oh great, now I've got to sit on council with this person and try to negotiate. It was the curriculum council. Figured we'd be fighting with each other the whole year I was on this council. Turned out that we ended up in very similar agreement about many things about academic curriculum, and we commented at the end of the year, we said, what an interesting dynamic that two of us who on theological and often ethical issues are mountains apart learn to listen to each other over the course of this year in negotiating some curriculum council issues, that now we have grown to really respect each other. I still don't agree with most of his political and religious ideas and vice versa, but we have learned that the place out of which we come brings a sense of respect for the other person's tradition, and it's been much safer for the two of us to engage in very intense discussion at some point without the need to kill off the neighbor. I think I mentioned one of the best interpretations I've read of the Genesis account, Genesis 2 and 3. Most often when I go through the Adam and Eve story and the understanding of the fall with my students, the notion of sin is, of course, disobeying God in the garden. But I read a Jewish, I wish I could remember his name, commentator who wrote that that's a prelude. And actually, if you look at it, the word sin is not mentioned in Genesis 2 and 3. It's not till Genesis 4 when in verse, I think it's 7, God says, sin is crouching at the door and you must master it. And of course, the sin there is what? The killing of the brother. Okay? And I thought that was a really interesting interpretation for this Jewish scholar post-Holocaust to talk about the fact that maybe our culture has misplaced its emphasis or at least needs to broaden its understanding of sin. Jack Nelson Pallmeyer and I both referred to the same quote this week about the fact that the religious question is not only Luther's question of how do I find a gracious God, but particularly for our culture, how do I find God in my enemies? How do I learn to see God's grace in those people that are labeled as them? And even more difficult, those people with whom in myself I really hate. And you can think of how we've done that as the enemy has changed through our history just in the country, how we categorize the enemy. And that's the powerful thing about Rollbach's book. When I show this video, and I've mentioned it, Letters from America, it's a sort of a commentary on Rollbach's life. At the turn of the century, there was incredible anti-immigration rhetoric going on in the upper Midwest. The governor of Minnesota is quoted about, you know, not allowing people to talk in German. This is during World War I because of the fear of, you know, the kinds of things that would happen. And of course, we're hearing that same, and the students, what they hear is, oh, we're hearing that same rhetoric now. So I think for me, the religious question has been, how do we talk theologically about our faith as a means of negotiating, getting through, moving through these differences? And I'm going to lift up conversation as one model. I think it's a problematic model. I've read enough feminist theology to know that there's a lot of critique of it. I'm just not sure, and I think it needs to be added to in terms of what it can bring. But conversation it raises some interesting questions. First of all, out of the piece we did yesterday, who is part of the conversation? I mean, part of the difficulty about questions that I have is who's going to get included as the ones who do the talking. Some groups are left out. We talked a lot about, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer sessions have focused a lot on children. I think another group that's becoming, you know, you think of elderly, you think of handicapped, you think of all the voices that we have labeled as other, that find it difficult to engage in conversation because they aren't given a voice in the first place. There's no sort of access point. So I think one critique of my own model is that it's difficult to bring voices together if they don't have a voice in the first place, or if the church has ruled them out as sinners, as people we don't want to listen to. I've mentioned how difficult it is in congregations and places to listen to those voices that seem strident, uncivil, inhospitable, other, dangerous. And yet, I think the question becomes, how do we understand what's at the heart of the Christian tradition if we don't begin to listen to those voices? We read that Matthew 25 text a few days ago. No, where were you? You did this to the least of me. And you look at those lists of people that Jesus spoke with, and we ask ourselves, who are those voices in our culture with whom we have the most difficulty? And how do we draw them into the conversation? And I think that's part of the problem with this whole agenda, is that already the conversation's a bit loaded between us and them. And I think there are some possibilities for beginning a strategy for how we deal with difference. But I think that the nature of the conversation itself is part of the problem. Comments or questions at this point?
You've almost come up with us, them, and others.
Hmm?
You've almost come up with the title us, them, and others.
Yeah, in a way, that's true. Yeah. The them becomes sort of a way of talking about others in its diverse sort of manner. And I think we have different thems. And we spent that first session sort of categorizing who them are. And it's often over issues of power, who has more power and who doesn't, who has the voice and who doesn't, who is allowed to speak. I'm much more aware that I have a significant, my voice is much louder at Augustana now that I'm tenured. It's interesting, the sort of relief that tenure brings. I remember a few years ago wanting to write an article for a journal and talking actually to Susan Thistlethwaite. And she said, don't write that now, wait till you're tenured. And I never forgot that advice because there are certain things I'd like to publish and do, but that are risky to say publicly. I've mouthed off anyway, but the point is now that I'm tenured, I feel a little bit safer. That some of the things I needed to say, I know I can't be removed from the college for saying them. Turns out, Augustana, I probably wouldn't have any trouble saying what I want to anyway, but we've talked about how tenure brings that sense of academic freedom. Or in other situations where you find, how do you create a safe place from which to say that which you need to without feeling that maybe you'll be removed from your job or you'll be isolated from members in your local congregation or whatever the kind of safety connection is. How do we create safe places to talk with one another about matters that cut so deeply into who we are? And I think that's part of the difficulty. When I looked yesterday at talking about how you understand yourself spiritually, if you have a conflict in your congregation over whether you table communion or do something else or whether you're going to do this or that, it's not just that issue, which at some level seems so ridiculous to get that upset over, but it hooks into something about the expression of your faith that I think is very intimate and very deeply rooted in who we are. So that when we bring spiritual matters to the table for discussion, it's not as if they're just objective issues out there that we can sort of talk about in an abstract, detached manner. I think the social sciences have taught us that. Yeah.
I would caution you to be a little bit careful about the concept that the plane of arrival at tenure is a totally freeing event. I do not have tenure. I do not have any job guarantee beyond tomorrow.
Sure.
But I'm an active professional in multiple professions. And I deal with the public where I choose to deal with the public. And anybody who tells me that they've arrived so they're free to talk is not free to talk.
Mm-hmm. I think the issue for that I've talked with, particularly in theological education, has been for a lot of women. And I have watched other women at other schools who bring things up and are threatened in their teaching positions.
And I can respect
hate
that.
Mail.
I grew up on a campus.
But I think the
and
sense
I understand that,
that tenure, what tenure has brought for me, I think, is a sense of even affirmation from the community of which I'm part of. It's not just to like jump through a hoop and now I'm okay. But then I sort of tested out and worked with this academic community and feel a sense of support for the work I've already done.
I respect that.
Yeah.
I understand it. But I just caution you, because it can be very entrapping.
Yeah, I suppose it could.
And it does.
Yeah.
Whether you're male or female.
Sure. Other comments? Okay, what I'd like to do next is present actually somebody else's material, but it has been an incredibly helpful sort of model for me about how we engage in difference. And then the last sort of third of the time, I have just some comments about where I think this conversational method leads us theologically. But this middle section is really sort of giving us a model or a diagram about two opposing issues and how we might see through that. And the material that I'm going to recommend is by a man named Ian Barber. And the book is called Religion in an Age of Science. One of the other fields that I do most of my new research in is in religion and science. And that is a situation, at least for a lot of students, in which they come into the classroom where there are two, it's really an us versus them. We often have students write down how they understand religion, how they understand science, and why are they in a class that's putting them together. It's a little bit like this marriage. Why are Peter and Susie, who look like exact opposites, put in a marriage, and how are they going to live with each other? I'll often hear things like science is the objective empirical truth. It deals with facts. Most scientists, I've had several students write, most scientists are atheists. They want to dispel Christianity. And then on the other side, you know, you'll hear things like faith. Religion is about faith, which is trusting in things you can't see. It doesn't have anything to do with the world out there. It's all my inner emotion. It's sort of these crass generalizations of religion and science. This last year, I taught a course. I've taught several sequences of religion and science, and this last year seemed to be, interestingly enough, the most edgy one. It was for senior religion and biology majors, and we taught a course called Faith in an Evolutionary Context. I taught with a biologist who actually specializes in ecology, and we start with this book by Ian Barber, who, if you're interested in it, he was a physicist for a long time at Carleton College, and also I think has his MDiv, so he had both a PhD in physics and at least master's level work in them. He's kind of considered the guru of religion and science, and has put together, I think, one of the finest texts about how these two fields relate, and in the first chapter gives a typology of these four different ways of these two fields relating to each other. And we had a variety of students in this class, from a couple very conservative Dutch Reformed students to a couple students who were not Christian. So the cover, it was a sort of interesting mixture of about 15 students for whom the discussion was, for some students, saying that evolution was not true and sort of doubting the scientific account or at least understanding of creation, to other students who felt that Genesis 1 was the only way to understand it, to other students who discounted scripture. So we had these very mixed group of people trying to engage in discussions about these two fields. And it became an interesting negotiating process for the other instructor and I to figure out how to engage in conversation that didn't end up in warfare. On occasion, the conversation became heated and intense, which was interesting. There's nothing wrong with that, but it was a struggle to try to figure out how to put these two together. So what we did, what Barber does, is to look at the fact that probably the first way people have experienced religion and science is in conflict. This is one method of relating to each other. There's really no access point. They just shoot. They shoot guns at each other. And of course, the major area that has been sort of in the public media has been the issue of evolution. And you hear students say, "Evolution is the only way to understand," you know, or it's Genesis 1. And what on both sides, even for the biology majors, who I can't imagine after 4 years of Augustana, all of a sudden discover that the scientific method isn't hard objective facts. They begin to discover things like philosophy of science, which talks about all knowledge as being socially constructed and paradigm dependent. But the conflict, what Barber points out that's so helpful, is that both sides understand their way of seeing as absolute truth. So for the scientific community in conflict, say about evolution, you could take scientific materialism, in which everything, the scientific material or scientific worldview reduces, becomes very reductionistic, and reduces the way of seeing everything through the scientific method and makes claims beyond science about the world. Okay, so it becomes sort of a reductionistic worldview in which scientific materialism makes claims about everything. The flip side of that, or its competitor, or its probably closest, is biblical literalism. Those who find scripture as inerrant and claim that Genesis 1 is the only valid way for understanding creation and make projections about scientific claims of reality from the beginning point of scripture. So they start from one field and make truth claims about the others in such a way that they know that their way is true, and it becomes a question of who And at that point, of course, you can't negotiate much, can you? And that kind of conflict, the Scopes trial, which occurred in Emperor, I was just relating to Brian Bonsenauer. We sat down over ice cream with some of you who have been attending his sessions. And 2 years ago, my husband and I were out at a conference at a Unitarian camp off the coast of New Hampshire. And this man was talking to us about the Scopes trial, and he said, yeah, I was there. And Gary and I, and this is in the early 1920s, I can't remember the date, but this man had turned like 95 that week up at Star Island, and he had been at the Scopes trial. So this question is often most framed, and as most of us know, the notion that creation versus evolution is even a false dichotomy in the first place. But that's the way it's set up. Most of us, including me, who have very little understanding of evolutionary theory, even after a semester or two of teaching, still find it incredibly technical theory, the same way that I found most students have not worked through the creation stories. So part of the educational factor is to try to break down this conflict method by looking at broader questions. But the marriage in the book looks like this most of the time. It's this intense conflict at which issues of authority and power, and I think that's one model for how we can relate to each other in our differences. Okay. Comments or questions about this?
Okay. It's really a model of obliterating the other.
Right.
So it's inherent. There's an inherently violent get rid of the other because it's untruth or heresy.
That's a really good point, because it is. It's a way of eradicating the other. So it's us getting rid of them. Yeah, because it's really an all-encompassing worldview. And it really does call up issues of heresy. We have a fair number of students who, after their first semester of biology 120, their whole, it's honestly, sometimes it's not the religion department that upsets their faith. All they have to do is go over to take biology 120. If they've come out of an experience of a different understanding of creation, they just, their whole world's sort of shaken. And accusations will get thrown at people. So I think that's really a good point. It's not just that we're in conflict, but it's conflict to the end of getting rid of the other, of wiping them out. One of the worst examples of that is probably Jewish-Christian. I mean, you think of how we've carried that to an extreme, not just in word, but in deed, of eradicating the other.
I see the incidence of that conflict approach growing in public life in America today, and I often wonder, why is that happening? Because My belief has always been that they're reconcilable conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Which, but I don't know well enough to sit down with two people arguing in conflict with each other to reconcile their conflict.
Yeah.
But I see it happening more and more and more.
That's a good point, because I think that, I don't know if it's fear or sort of what social structures are working toward that, but it does seem to be the sense that we can't resolve the conflict, or that we can't somehow...
Well, what I hear all the time is, it's not reconcilable.
Yeah.
This is the way it is.
Yep. Yeah. Yes.
But another piece of it is that our sense of self, ideas are not somehow separated from selves.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so everything is an ad hominem attack. And so discourse cannot have any distance from your persona.
That's a wonderful comment.
And yet that's the role where the true church has to provide the reconciliation, because the anti-ethical position is, I'm going to get you because you're wrong based on my religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, what kind of religion do I have?
don't you think that we held up politics as the one place where there could be public discourse that would have that distance?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when the point, I'm not enough of a historian to know when that discourse shifted so radically, but it certainly is not present at any level of government that I'm aware of anymore.
Mm-hmm. And that's surely true in issues of faith. I mean, for many students, the public discussion of faith, I spend weeks with texts talking about theology's public discourse as being language for the marketplace. That one of the ways we try to overcome this is that so much of the faith has become very privatized. And consequently, your argument's even more true to the point, because then if there, for instance, this one poor student who was Dutch Reformed, I think felt a little more attacked personally because he was clearly in the minority with these Lutherans and Catholics, and began to feel personally attacked and took it that way, that what was happening to him was an attack on who he was. And that's, I think that becomes a question about how we have a public theology. I've been reading a little bit lately in Parker Palmer's work, which I'd recommend to any of you. His whole cry is for theology of the public arena. And his little book, I think it's called Welcoming the Stranger, or somebody might help me with that title, something the Stranger.
Company of Strangers.
And he uses the image of Eucharist as the place where we break bread together with strangers, and how, interestingly enough, he's very critical of the notion of family for church. And I have some sympathy with that, because what it does is call in the sense of intimacy in which we're all supposed to be really close, but it becomes very personal. And of course, then we're unable to reach out to those who are strangers. So he calls for a sort of a shifting of the discourse to what he calls the school of the spirit, in which we become educated to talk to one another in the spirit of the faith that allows for these tensions to be looked at without engaging in these sort of family personal dynamics. We had a long conversation up here last week about whether family is an appropriate metaphor for the Christian church, or how helpful is it, what are its problems and its possibilities in it. And one of the critiques is that, you know, it doesn't allow for distance in the conversation. It's also a helpful metaphor, but it does have some problems. So this need for a public theology is part of my concern for this conversation, is that it calls the church to be accountable. I'm really nervous about some of the movements in contemporary theology. Some of you may be familiar with sort of the narrative linguistic school that wants theology to be only the discourse of the community of faith, as if it has no conversation or access point outside of the community. And I think until we realize that we're publicly accountable for what we say and how we say it, we're going to keep running into this problem of sort of a personalized form of discussion.
So. Well, I'm curious, where do you think there are any models for healthier?
I can see them on sort of, I'm not going to even try to lift up any national sorts of things. I've seen some grassroots sorts of hopeful things. One is this odd group of people, and I mean that in a nice way, that I work with in religion and science. This group that we meet with off the coast of New Hampshire are scholars and people from all religious walks of life. Most of this group is Unitarian, but there are a number of Christians, some Jewish people, some Buddhist scholars, scientists, theologians, and it's not that there isn't some interesting interactions, but because this field is so new in terms of its academic discourse, there's sort of a common goal in trying to make the material available, interesting, and literate, and so there's really been an attempt to try to work through discourse together in a fairly hospitable way. Karen?
Yeah, I think in answer to John's inquiry, there's, as I see it, lots of different initiatives arising. The study circle movement, mm-hmm. through the Kettering Foundation, mm-hmm. you know, in terms yeah. of discourse around public issues okay. in society that I think are trying to do that. And I mean, certainly in our work in the ELCA, we've been trying to do that around what it means for the church to be a community of moral deliberation mm-hmm. about issues. And certainly some of the reactions to that, I'd shared this with Anne before, but I think a lot of it is trying to control or homogenize that, mm-hmm. or people who become very threatened because of some of the absolute truth yeah. kinds of postures that they're operating out of, and the necessary perspectiveness mm-hmm. That we each bring to those issues gets obliterated because people want the truth. And what do you mean we have to deliberate about how we should go about this, or around questions of abortion, sexuality, sure, and the warfare that can erupt around those issues?
That's a good point, because I think the question, it is a question of how we go about it. And the fear that we're going to make every, I mean, I think that's some of the fear I hear, is we're going to all end up in a certain place, and this notion of multiplicity of voices, that's why I keep going back to some of the work I've done reading-wise in feminist philosophy of science, the Sandra Harding's work, which has been so interesting. To talk about how we incorporate these voices means that there's going to be dissonance, and that dissonance doesn't have to lead to obliteration. And I think that's the leap that we make so often, is that we're so uncomfortable with conflict or with anger or with tough decisions that sometimes we leap because of our desire to manage or our desire for the absolute truth or whatever the sort of goal is, fear of something, that we make the leap to categorize these diverse voices as them or other, and then we can't engage and listen to the tensions that those voices will raise.
A couple of points. One of them is that I think our education system is going to continue to be taxed in its approaches to education, because we tend to, in the information age, where the volume of information impacting everybody is just growing exponentially and will continue to, mm-hmm, without limit other than capital to finance it, we still tend to do a lot of education on planes, and not in a global sense of learning, mm-hmm, to think. And until we change that fundamental approach in education to teach people how to think globally and not planarly, mm-hmm, we're going to have a problem. And I learned that probably best in healthcare, mm-hmm, where as a registered nurse, I learned in school there's a good way to do this. And in the field, I learned there are six ways to accomplish the same thing, and I better be able to customize the approach to the patient, mm-hmm, and the situation. And in the ethical framework, you better look at it globally or you won't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And yet, that ultimately has to be the approach that works, because what I see in the planar approach is, in my true faith, you're limiting my God, I won't accept it. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference that I see. Now, the other thing that I see is that the technological revolution that society is going through, mm-hmm, is going to continue to drive a lot of polar thinking.
Sure.
And because I call it the critical mass of information that's just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You know, I always tell people, download before you upload, because you overload. So you don't overload. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're just going to continue to have more and more information. And that aggravates the conflict issue.
Sure it does. And the need, I like your notion of thinking through options, that instead of coming things from an either or, I mean, you learn to think from the very process of education in a multitude of ways to approach things. I'm going to move on unless there's a second model, and I'm going to list all of these on the board, and then we can kind of pick up from there. This pen is sort of running out, so I'll explain what these are. The second model of dealing with difference is independence. Get a divorce, don't talk to each other. A student gave an example when I go over to the science building to teach. Some of my freshmen will say, aren't you in the wrong building? In other words, what you need to do then is bifurcate the world in which you live. Religion belongs over here and science belongs over here, and you can sort of live in a compartmentalized world. It's a little bit what you're talking about, the sort of either-or thinking. It allows one to sort of live apart from those tensions by saying, well, science thinks about stuff this way and religion thinks about it this way, and they're really two different ways of talking about the world. And so you live really apart from the other. I know marriages like that, you know, where people sort of live in two separate ways and they kind of travel on two continuous paths. But there's no need to bring the two together in some sort of arrangement. Of course, my theological problem with this is, in the conversation, say, for instance, between religion and science, is that we live in one world. And at least it seems to me both have an investment in how this world works. So that's at least just on one edge a theological critique. Third is what I would call dialogue, or just initial conversation, bringing to the table partners to talk about maybe boundary questions. For religion and science, it might be something like, what's our nature of the origins, or where are our endings, or what's the meaning of the world in which we live? It's not yet an integration of ideas, but it's at least a coming to the table to sit down and share with each other from your own perspective where the issues are around what I would call sort of boundary questions. And then the fourth model, and of course this is where Barber thinks we all should be, and you may not agree with this, but this is sort of his movement through the typology, is integration. Or you might say marriage or partnership, in which religion and science come together not to form the same field, but mutually share and are transformed by each other's fields. That the content, that the world in which we live and our understanding of it is informed by the other, by the other. Okay? Now, what happens in this is that there's a sense of, I think, of mutual transformation. Of course, there's great risk in it. But the integration that happens means that, in a sense, there's newness that comes out of this. It's more than just sitting down at the table and sharing ideas. It's a movement towards new ideas, new ways of understanding. And of course, that's the hope. You're desperately working with poor Barrett, and I mean with Peter and Susie in this book, to hope that they'll, and they go through really all four of these stages. It's a fascinating, and Barber's point is that most of us are in all four of these at some point. It's not as if we all live in the integration model or we all live in the conflict model, but most of us have some of those models within each of us, depending on what the voice of the other is. But the integration model, in which conversation takes place as a means for dealing with difference, I think, and I'm just going to sort of spell out where I think some of the interesting things theologically goes, and then I'll open it up for questions. If conversation becomes a method for negotiating difference, first of all, I think there's an element, and I find this, I think, a promise. There's a risk in that you don't know what the other person will say. You can't predict the outcome of the conversation. Those conversations in which you're most intensely involved have a certain novelty and unpredictability to them. It's not as if sort of what you're negotiating about has already been arrived at, but it's the process itself that leads to the new ideas. And this seems fairly simple, but there will be no single simple answer. The conversation itself should reflect the ambiguity and what I would call the multiple voices of those involved in the conversation, and reflect what we started with, which is the messiness of our lives. That hopefully the conversation becomes grounded in the participants of the people who are talking in such a way that the theology itself is an outgrowth of that. Instead of the theology being doctrine or ideas that sort of are handed, you know, Karen, this is your sort of management thing. It's the notion that instead of what we believe is being handed to us and we believe it, we really move the other way. We start with the local participants, and out of that we understand what we believe. And I'm so firmly convinced of that anyway, because I really think theology grows out of practice anyway. I'm just, in terms of what I hope for the process, but it means that doctrine will arise out of this notion of the practice and conversation of our faith that's grounded in who we are as church. And I think that's a different movement. There will be, in a sense, how we negotiate this question that I think I haven't solved yet, or probably won't, question of particular and universal. What do we make about the sort of the essential universal claims of the faith, and yet how do they live in the tensions of our communities, of who we are? How do we talk about baptism as an essential part of the Christian faith when there are Baptists and Catholics and Methodists and Lutherans? And what is it going to mean to talk about basic claims of the faith given the multiplicity of these conversations? And what can we even talk about as sort of universals I haven't figured that out yet. And it may be that in the time in which we're, it's sort of a premature. Second, it may be that difference is just that. That sometimes what we perceive as threat or as fear of listening to the voice is not something that's going to destroy us. It's just different. That people talk in ways that we're not used to. And that learning to negotiate this us-them is learning to see, that's what I've learned from Deborah Tannen's material, is that sometimes conflicts are not essentially about somebody trying to get the answer, but they genuinely reflect differences in conversation style. In other words, it may be that a community goes about its way of thinking in such a way that at first seems offensive or threatening, but it's simply that, just different. And it's learning to live in that for a while and feel what that's about. And I think the final thing for me about theological method with conversation is that it reflects for me what's at the heart, at least for me, of the understanding of the Christian faith, sort of my non-negotiable, which is the sort of the loosening, the freeing of God's grace in such a way that we're not bound, finally, and I think Lutherans, so convinced of this, understand faith as belief, as right content, that what we need to keep being free to do is to learn to talk about matters of the faith in such a way that we're freed to have conversation without seeing it as the equivalent of the faith. We've had long talks among the Lutheran women about why we keep having trouble getting published. And some of it has to do, I think, with loyalty about correct belief and correct doctrine and who determines whose doctrine is getting published and all those kinds of things. And some of it comes back for me to a re-examination, and it's been really helpful to be at Holden here for 2 weeks. I've had baptism lifted up as an image again of the community of faith in which all those distinctions of us and them fall apart. That baptism becomes the equalizing metaphor for who we are as a community of faith in the sense of those who come together around the central acts of the faith to begin to work out what it is we believe through our difference, not just in spite of it. So those are some of the positive things, I think, that come out of conversation. And like I said earlier, my biggest sort of own warning about that method is that I worry about the voices who can't get into the conversation in the first place. And it may be that this metaphor is just, which I think it is, one among many about how we begin to negotiate these boundaries of us and them. Okay. Comments? Questions? Karen?
You described the dilemma of negotiating particular and universal, mm-hmm. and I think one of the, you know, I really affirm and like a lot of what you're laying down mm-hmm. because I think it's very helpful. I think one of the difficulties is we live in a time where culturally there's a lot of nervousness about hearing those particular voices and the caricaturing of, well, politically correctness, mm-hmm. and, you know, the identity, everyone has their own identity, and the subjectivity that people, you know, mm-hmm. think that's all there is. And so there's a real nervousness when, you know, to refer to your paradigm a couple of days ago, when the modern paradigm of there being certain universals, mm-hmm. which we then cling to for our security, when the notion that that may emerge through some other ways, it doesn't mean anything goes, but
right.
I think those for whom we want the universals and we want that clear, and we certainly want our pastor to be clear in how he or she
yeah.
proclaims those to us, and if that doesn't come through clear, it's what. Yeah, so I think that whole challenge of how one raises up those particularities
mm-hmm.
in a way that can deal with that very real anxiety that
mm-hmm.
is there as we, you know, shift from a more modern to a more postmodern way of viewing things.
It's
describing a dilemma I know you're aware of anyway.
Yeah. I think it happens. I have a couple friends who are clergy who are very afraid of approaching certain issues within their congregation because of this dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Fear that if they don't sort of come out with a certain pronouncement, they're not going to get their salary, or they'll, you know, I mean, they'll have very difficult times ahead in their congregations. And in some cases, experience has proved it. You know, but I think it's stepping back again, and I've really enjoyed these conversations about how we begin the conversation. If the conversation, as you said, is seen as the dropping down of the authority from the clergy to lay people to give the answers, that sort of universal conversation, when what we could look for is sort of a stirring of the mixture to elicit or evoke out of the conversation, that's a very different way of approaching things than this sort of need. And I think there is a lot of anxiety.
Well, and a lot of that can be relieved in the reconciliation of the conflict of creationism.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the cellular growth of the body.
Mm-hmm.
One of the elderly that I cared for a number of years taught me probably better than anybody else, the more you know, the more you know you don't know.
Yeah.
And what a source of hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you always have an opportunity to learn more.
There's a sense of receptivity and openness about it.
Yeah.
Right.
And one of the dynamics that she taught me was that's how I got to be as old as I am, was I was so busy learning and didn't have time to think about it.
Yeah. I think that's... Yeah, there's a posture to which you can be receptive and open to the world and to be... And I think that's becoming more and more important for me as a theological agenda. It's not just that I can sort of be with people and find it open, but that theologically there's sort of a prior sense of reconciliation, a freedom out of which we can begin these difficult conversations that's not dependent on our good judgment or not dependent on coming to the right answer or all these sort of conditions that I think arise out of this anxiety. For me, it's still sort of a fundamental stepping back, and that's why I still like going back to read Luther, of somebody who not always handled conflict terribly well, but I think period, in fact, sometimes terribly, but who understood that it was the prior sense of God's grace that allowed him to take a stand in the first place. This notion of, you know, here I take a stand, and of course we've struggled with this issue. It doesn't mean just relativity. It doesn't mean just anything goes. It means allowing oneself to be grounded in the beliefs and understandings out of which they come in a way that's, again, open to others. And I think for me that's a fundamental commitment of my own theological tradition, coming out of a Lutheran tradition, that I don't ever want to give up. It's that sense of being freed and opened up from God's grace that one is allowed as a community of discourse to deal with these terribly difficult boundaries of us and them in a way that is not dependent on all these conditions that we put. And of course, I think that only happens, for me at least, through the practice of the community. It means being in community, being in church with, being partners with, listening to. It's like, I think back to that story of being on curriculum council with this government teacher, who I had really, frankly, stereotyped. You know, conservative government teacher, I'm sure we're just going to end up in the same old political. Turned out we had some very odd interests about honors programs and nature of students, and found that after this, we both changed some. And it took a long time. But there was this sort of negotiating and listening and finally permission with each other. And some of the sort of characterization of liberal and conservative and this and that had changed. Yeah.
The dynamics of that transformation are interesting because you were structured into an ongoing conversation for a period of time. And what I experience in conversations in congregations is that there may be little forays, you know, little attempts, but the risk is so great and the ease of walking away from the conversation is so appealing the minute the intensity goes up. We don't have places where we know it's just normal for us to be in conflict. That's what it means to be a healthy community.
Yeah.
And now we sort of move through it. There really aren't a lot of places, unless you happen to have been lucky and have a family where that was sort of normal.
Yeah. I was talking to our bishop right before I left, and she said that her fear about the coming generation is that there's no loyalty to the church. She said they don't have loyalty to the institution. And she wasn't being terribly critical, but just saying we're facing changing factors in how people are loyal to institutions. And in the sense that people come and go and leave and change and move through different places so that there isn't this stable... I think that's a good point. The congregation has not yet
Well, one of the things that I see in the church, but I also see it in economics, is exactly this type of thing of the four things come together on a cellular basis. Small groups in the church. One of the things I like the best of the church that I've been going to recently and joined is that now you enter the mission field is what you see as you leave the church. And the small groups are where the conflict and the dialogue and the discourse and the planning for how we're going to spring forth in mission come about. And it's very empowering. And it's not just in that church. There's a network nationwide of small groups of Christian Lutheran people, men and women, doing this. And it's growing by leaps and bounds.
I think another good example of that is something like 12-step groups, you know, for which there's a sort of common core that begins to link in little tiny groups that eventually become sort of a worldwide phenomena. But it's not imposed, I mean, there's no, and that's such an interesting structure to me. There's no 12-step of 12-step groups. You can't go to, you know, 12-step Anonymous 101 New York Avenue or something, you know. It's this sort of body that keeps growing in and out. So I think you've got a good
point. I happened to visit a mega church north of Chicago recently, and this is exactly what they do in bringing people to Christ. They meet their 7-step program. One of them is joining a small group of common mission, whether it's location or profession or issue or whatever it is. Every member of that church, and they are going to 20,000 this year, is a member of a small group, active in mission.
We have small groups at our church. They're called caring groups, but I always laugh at them. It's like caring group number 329. Somehow they got to find a way to change that. But yes,
in the small congregation, the minister is saddled with not being able to educate freely congregation or change its direction. And, you know, another paradigm has to be put into action. We can't borrow from these large churches because we're not large. Small groups tend to be social groups or have a gourmet aspect or some other label. They very seldom are sources of dynamic change in any direction. That's a problem. If you work out that paradigm, you will be able to take your small congregations, begin to re-enthuse them or something. Right now, they look at their pastors as little Christs. The problem with that is it isn't God deciding what Christ is going to do. It's each member deciding what this Christ is going to do. And the poor guy can't win or gal.
There's a sense of ownership in these. Well, I think that's a really...
I'm in the academic world also, and there is a difference. Your academic experiences could not happen.
Yeah, I think there are different worlds, and I think you're calling for new paradigms. It's going to be part of this. It's a problem. I mean, I don't have any words of solution other than to say I think you're right about the difference in these congregations.
It occurs to me that part of what I see, not just within churches, but generally in the kind of political discussions that Jack talked about in his presentations, is that people, there are so many people who want things to be the way they cannot be. I mean, they want things to be like they were before. They don't want to deal with all of the changes that have gone on, and so there's not an openness sometimes to the kind of integration or even the dialogue itself, because there just has to be a way to bring us back to a sense of community or whatever we're talking about. And the same thing happens within the church. The lack of recognition that things are not today like they were before. And I think the church has been very slow to make accommodations for the way things are in reality in the world and the way we deal with all issues, really.
We have this ongoing conversation in Augustana about the fact that community isn't like it used to be because, of course, most of the faculty were men, and there was the Augie spouse group, the faculty wives who had a certain sense of community, and there was there was a certain, you know, all the kids, and there was a, I gathered, a very different feeling. Most people lived close to the campus. The families were involved. It was a different sense. That has changed. There is a radically different structure of how that campus works now. And so your point, I think both of you, is that we need to talk about new ways of creating community. And we simply can't say, well, we'll go back to, because it isn't working the way it used to. So it's this need for, yes?
Which kind of comes back to the thing I talked about in the, another day, about how do we handle two things? How do we handle change, and how do we handle the pace of change?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've found very, very helpful for people who are struggling with change is to try to fundamentally alter their perspective and mission. I've been a nursing home administrator for 10 years. If you want to see people who've coped well with change, you come to the nursing home and talk to the residents. And they'd be delighted to have you come.
Yeah.
And you'll hear stories that just are unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can talk to people every day who've lived since before the automobile, before radio, before television, before world wars, you know, all this stuff, and hear what they're doing to live today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tremendous learning process of mission. Just the visit is a mission, because mm-hmm. they're delighted to have you visit.
And the experience there, surely.
And you just, if you can overcome your fears of catching what they have, which first of all is old age, I love to catch it.
Yeah.
But the second thing that I love to catch is the ability to cope with suffering well, which many of them have.
Mm-hmm.
But if you overcome your fears, the benefits you get are tenfold what you give them. The other thing about the pace of change, again, you got download before you upload, or you overload.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we as a society are so inundated with worthless information and needless information. We have to look at the information we're taking in. God made the best computer ever made, and historically, it's never been used beyond 10 to 15%.
Or brain, yeah.
And
sure.
And you know, the information overload is what most people are terrified of.
Mm-hmm.
They don't download, but they just keep soaking it in. And they don't make meaning of it. It's terrifying. Now, the economists say that with all this information going on, one of the new economies that's just exploding is matching up old ideas and new ideas with old information, new information, and creating economies that will just keep the economy growing in brand new ways all over the place, but it creates change. And that's happening. And that's going to continue to happen. You know, they just have discovered a real strong likelihood of life on Mars,
mm-hmm.
in a meteorite in Antarctica. The theology of that is real exciting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it expands the horizon
sure
of who God might really be. You know,
that's it. I think that's a good sort of closing metaphor to let go on, is how we're going to, this us versus them is really an issue of how we live our faith amidst the ambiguity and change in our world. And I think I'm just going to leave that with you and remind you, if you need a book, to pick up Rollvog, but just to leave that sort of tension that I've tried to raise this week, not to solve clearly, but just to raise in some ways. So thank you, and we'll see you wherever.